Hi. So I first met Sadie Zagarek when she was a student here. And she is a friendship ninja. You should know this about Sadie. So after kind of as she was still a student, and then when she graduated, she kind of like snuck her way into my life. And now she's one of my very best friends. And now also one of my colleagues here in the Office of Christian Ministry. And so I know that we tease Sadie a lot because she's kind of a theology nerd. It's true. She has earned that. But she's also a pastor. And so she is passionate about both sides of that because she wants to explore the depths of who God is so that we can know God better. And so I'm very excited for her to share with us tonight. Let's welcome Sadie.
Thanks, everyone. I have to get a stand. So I'll be right back. Sorry, Leah. It's going to be screwed up, but that's okay. Thank you for having me and welcoming me. Mallory gave me an appropriate introduction, so I don't feel like I need to say much more. Except for that I'm sick, and so it's really going to bum me out if I accidentally cough into the microphone, because you'll all be awake, but that would just also be sad. And I'm going to keep my water, because maybe you're thinking what I think when people have water with microphones, which is, that's disgusting, I'm going to be able to hear her drink water through that microphone. But I assure you, I will try my best not to make that happen either. Anyway, so we've been in a series on Leviticus. These are the worst. Okay. And thanks to Mallory's lovely poll of what you all wanted to hear about. And to be honest, like, I really wasn't sure that this, like, a sermon series on Leviticus to me was like, oh, that could be a little bit brutal too. Because there comes a moment in the life of ministry where you realize that there are just a few books that you'd probably rather not give sermons on. So like Numbers, no one really cares about consensus data. Revelation, it's like, holy cow, all of you have a different opinion, so that's fun. And then Leviticus, which, like, how could we possibly learn anything from a stuffy, repetitive book about law? So anyone you talk to in ministry probably had that moment at some point in their life where they're like, dear Lord, don't make me. But then we pull you, and you want to hear about books like Revelation and Leviticus. So this is because of you, this sermon series. But on a serious note, like, I have had so much fun in this series, too, seeing the faithfulness of God through Corey speaking 2 weeks ago and Spencer speaking last week. But this week, we're going to talk about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16. And so, as Mallory said, this is, in fact, my favorite topic in my theological research, but I'm going to try to make it pretty exciting for you, too. If you talk to me in, like, a very academic way about this, your eyes might start to glaze over, but that's not why we're here. So, but we're going to set ground rules first, but we're going to start with a definition before we get to that. So, atonement is not a real word. Super helpful, I'm sure, for you. It's three words smashed into one, at one mint. So, at one time, something happens. All at once, there's, like, the saving grace of Jesus and something that God's doing both objectively in the whole world and subjectively for your heart. And it's, like, this big conglomeration of stuff that's all happening at the same time. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. But the rules are as follows. One, a lot of people have a lot of different questions around atonement and when it specifically happens and what exactly happens. So know that that is true. There are a lot of different people talking about it. Number two, we're only going to cover one piece of it tonight. Number three, I will not be wading into any other areas other than that one piece. Four, the atonement of Christ is something that our whole faith is built around. And number five, it's just like a kaleidoscope. So the more you turn it, and the more you look at it, and the more time you spend with it, the more you find. So from number five, I'm going to tell you to see number two, that we're only going to cover one piece of it. We're only going to look at one part of the kaleidoscope, and I'm happy to talk after, but just know that those things are true. But now that we've set boundaries, we're going to pray and jump in. Lord, I thank you for your presence in this space tonight. I ask that you would speak to the hearts of your people, and that the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart would be pleasing to you, O God. Amen. Okay, so a little bit of background to Leviticus is organized in a way that goes like this. The beginning and the end are about rituals. The next piece is about priests, which you heard Spencer talk about last week. Then it discusses things called purity and different rites and stuff like that. And then right in the middle is this peculiar little section, two chapters directly in the center, that talks about one of the rituals super in depth called the Day of Atonement. And something about the Old Testament in general is that it's a lot more about the things that are being done rather than the reason behind why we're doing the things. So worship in the Old Testament consists of festivals and sacrifices. So that's not super like what you just experienced where you're singing in this space about the faithfulness of Jesus. These people didn't know who Jesus was. They did not know the song Good to Me by Audrey Assad. And they killed things, which I don't think happened tonight. So super different. But all of these festivals and all of these sacrifices, like the purpose of them, was to demonstrate that all of life relates to the character and to the action of God. Or as they would refer to him, Yahweh, but they actually wouldn't even say that out loud. So his name's Yahweh in the Old Testament. So Leviticus 16, this part in the middle, goes through the details of how the priest is to prepare for the Day of Atonement, which in that context is an annual festival that the Israelites celebrate for their yearly cleansing of the people. And so it's important for the priest to make right the sins of the collective people so that God's holiness is once again able to be with them. They believed that God could not be interacted with if you were unclean, and so you had to be made clean so that God could interact with you. But after the details about that in Leviticus 16, after the details of the priest's wardrobe, he's supposed to offer a bull as a sacrifice for his own sin and for the sin of the household. But then he takes two goats. One is a sacrifice, and one is a scapegoat. And the sacrificial goat is killed, and the scapegoat is sent into the wilderness alive. Then there are some more details about how to go about more of the ritual until we get to verses 29 to 34, which are going to be on the screen, and I will read them right now. This ritual is to be a lasting ordinance for you. On the 10th day of the 7th month, you must deny yourselves and not do any work, whether native-born or foreigner residing among you, because on this day, atonement will be made for you, to cleanse you. Then, before the Lord, you will be clean from all your sins. It is a day of Sabbath rest, and you must deny yourselves. It is a lasting ordinance. The priest who is anointed and ordained to succeed his father as the high priest is to make atonement. He is to put on the sacred linen garments and make atonement for the most holy place, for the tent of meeting and the altar, and for the priests and all the members of the community. This is to be a lasting ordinance for you. Atonement is to be made once a year for all the sins of the Israelites, and it was done as the Lord commanded Moses. So what we see here, and what I just described to you, is that God created a way for the people of Israel to be made clean. And so this is all about community. Like, all throughout the year, there were different individuals and different families offering different sacrifices, different grain offerings, stuff like that, in order to be made clean themselves. But this ritual is made once a year, and it's all about community. It's about the people. And so there had to be something going on in the mind of God to say that it's important that the people as a collective whole are made clean, not just individuals who are then coming together as a community. But we're going to put that in your pocket and save it, and we'll come back to that. But first, we need to do some background work on another character that's in this story called the scapegoat. So we learned about sacrifice 2 weeks ago from Corey. We learned about priests last week from Spencer. And if you missed those, there's a fancy little website called thewellashland.com. Those sermons are there. So you can tell that I'm not lying. But there's a new element in play here. There's a new character in our story, and that is the scapegoat. And before I started paying any serious attention to the atonement story throughout the Old and New Testament, I probably didn't even know that the scapegoat was a thing. And if I did, I probably thought the scapegoat and sacrifice could be used interchangeably to talk about the same thing. But they aren't, and they can't be. For one thing, the sacrifice is killed, and the scapegoat is sent out alive. And those two things seem to be pretty fundamentally different to me. I think that's true. So what is it? We see two goats in chapter 16. The one is for sacrifice, and it's used as a sin offering to cleanse the most holy place and to cleanse the tent of meeting. But the scapegoat is different. The priest lays his hands. I want you to picture this. A human being laying their hands on the head of a goat, just like pretty casual, and confessing over it all of the wickedness and all of the rebellion of the Israelites. That's a long list. That is a long time to keep your hands on the head of a goat. I don't know, maybe it wanted to run away. It does eventually, but not yet. And so all the sins, and he's putting them on the goat's head. And then what the priest does is he just sends the goat away into the wilderness, carrying the sins of Israel, like, out of the community. And so if that is the thing that the sins are being put on, it's not being killed, it's being sent away. And so in a very literal sense, the goat is carrying all the sins of the collective community of Israel out of their presence. But the goat isn't killed. If there are pictures firing up in your head about Jesus, that's good. Hold on to those. We'll get there in a little bit. Because he's intimately and intricately related to this whole entire process. And these people didn't even know who he was yet. But before we get there, we're going to talk about a movie called Interstellar. Have you seen it? Good. That's lovely. If you haven't, you've had plenty of time to see it, and I'm not super sorry that I am going to ruin it for you. But at some point, the basic sense of the movie is that Earth is unlivable. It's not a planet that we can stay on, and so we have to find a new place that will sustain humans. Joel, you would probably do a way better job of this plot summary, but see him after class. But if it's not terrifying enough that the world could, like, not be sustainable soon in our lives, this is a whole movie about it. But there's a set of astronauts sent out on a mission to find a livable planet. They arrive eventually, I'm skipping a whole chunk, but they find this planet where this doctor is named Dr. Mann, and he's living there, but he's in this, like, weird sci-fi induced coma that they have to wake him up from. It's not super important to us how he got there, just he's there. So they wake him up from this weird thing, and they're like, who are you? We know about you. And he eventually convinces them that he can be trusted and that he cares about humanity as a broad-scale thing, that he is looking out for generations to come, all of this good stuff. So they trust him to help them find this planet. So you fast forward, and there's one of the astronauts that went on this mission. His name's Cooper. And he and Dr. Mann are fighting because Cooper thought that he could trust Dr. Mann based on who he thought that he was. But Dr. Mann goes on to say that it's impossible for man to look past himself into the well-being of those to come. So essentially what he's saying is that we can't look out for future generations because we're worried about the preservation of self. And so man just wants to survive and get home. He He doesn't care about the mission anymore. He and Cooper can't survive the journey back together, and so he tries to kill Cooper in order to save himself. You can watch the rest of the movie or talk to Joel Vanderzijden about the rest if you're interested. But I tell you this story in the middle of a sermon, this story about the minuteness of humankind, this story about how it's actually incredibly difficult to think about the preservation of humanity instead of the preservation of self. I tell you this story because you can probably identify with most of it. Even if you don't want to, you do. But I mostly tell you this story so that I can demonstrate to you exactly who God isn't. God isn't short-sighted or selfish. He isn't impatient or unkind. He doesn't give up when we rebel, and he doesn't try to kill us so that his purposes can succeed. He wants his children to experience love and goodness and life that only he can offer. And he is faithful. You sang about that. Every single song was that. And I sat there as you were singing King of My Heart, and you all were proclaiming that you're never going to let me down. And that was one of the most beautiful moments for me to just, like, stop singing and to listen to the proclamation of God's people to say, we believe that you are good. Like, I scream sang that song at retreat this past weekend and lost my voice and then got super sick. So I got sick because I was screaming about the goodness of God, which, if that's not a good enough excuse, I don't know what is. But God's faithful all the way from creation to the life of Moses, which is where we find Leviticus. God's giving the law to Moses. And then he's faithful from Moses all the way to Jesus, which is 30-ish generations, depending on your definition of how long a generation is. And for the sake of finishing out history, he's faithful from Jesus all the way to us right here in this moment at the well on October 5th, 2017. He's still faithful, which that's thousands of years that he has been putting this plan into motion to prove to you that he is faithful and worthy of your trust. And so I have about a million stories about God's faithfulness in my life, but since the theme of this is that we're going to be zooming out to look at a lot of history, I figure we should zoom out and look at my life too. So things that are true about my life is that I come from a family where alcoholism, like, reared its ugly head and has destroyed a lot of things. I come from a family where no one is still married except for one couple. I come from a family that didn't really talk about much, and vulnerability wasn't real life. Like, I go home for family stuff, and I don't really know much about my family, but we magically do this small talk thing for 5 hours, and it's awesome. And so, like, drilling in on that alcoholism piece, like, I look at my life, and I didn't grow up in a Christian home either, and so there wasn't really a reason that I should have been faithful to the Lord from middle school into high school into college. Like, no one was telling me that that was, like, a good thing to do. I didn't have my family being like, yeah, we love Jesus too, and you should, and look at his faithfulness in our family. I was like, well, I guess that those people, those Christians over there, have joy that I've never really seen, and I guess I want that, because it seems better than what's right now. And so I look at my life, and I see that the Lord has been faithful to me to take me to a youth group where I found a family, that wasn't blood, but it was much deeper than that, and to bring me to a university that I did not want to go to, and planted me straight into this community to walk with people who loved me enough to say, hey, you're broken, and we want to know about it, and we want you to love Jesus enough to let him heal you. And so I then stayed here after graduation, which I really didn't want to do, and I learned a whole lot about what it looks like to stay and stop running away from everything. And so I'm in these moments in life, and I'm like, this is actually super hard. But then when I'm standing here and I'm looking, I'm like, no, God, you are faithful. Like, you are the one that brought me to these places. And your story probably sounds a lot different than that. But I want you to zoom out, and I want you to notice that God has been faithful to your life. And if you can't do that, I'm going to believe it for you until you can. Because he is. And it's not a thing that he does to, like, accomplish a task. He's not like, all right, I'll be faithful and manipulate my people so that I can get this thing that I want. He's faithful because he can't help but to be faithful, because it is fundamentally who God is. And so my life is just part of the bigger story. But we're going to jump into the New Testament, and we're going to see that it's a lot bigger than my life, and it's a lot bigger than your life, and like, that's the best news ever. So we're going to go to Hebrews, specifically chapters 9 and 10. And earlier in Hebrews, so before chapter 9, we find titles such as Melchizedek, that's a fun one, Melchizedek as priest, followed by a title, Jesus as Melchizedek. And then we see Jesus being described as the high priest, which we talked a little bit about last week. And then we read of worship in the early tabernacle in such a way that, quote, these rituals are an illustration for the present time. They're only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. So that's the writer of Hebrews talking about the Old Testament law, and the new order is Jesus. And so all of those things were shadows, he'll call it in a little bit. But we continue on in chapter 9, and the writer makes it pretty clear that the law was only a shadow of the good things in store for the future. So there needed to be a better and there needed to be a more complete sacrifice made once and for all. And in chapter 10, verses 3 and 4, the writer of Hebrews flat out tells us, like, doesn't even let this go to question, that, quote, the sacrifices are an annual reminder of sins. It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. So if this is starting to sound even more like Jesus, that's because it's all about Jesus. So in chapter 9, verses 26 through 28, it says, but he has appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. Just as people are destined to die once and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. And I don't really want to mince words, and I don't want to make you trust me, so we're just going to keep reading into Hebrews, if you don't mind, because this stuff, like, says it better than I can, which is, I guess, why it's scripture. But we'll pick up in chapter 10, verse 8, and it says, First Jesus said, sacrifices and offerings, burnt offerings and sin offerings, you did not desire, nor were you pleased with them, though they were offered in accordance with the law. Then he said, here I am. I have come to do your will. So Jesus sets aside the first to establish the second. And by that will, we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all. And what this one's talking about a little bit is that Jesus sacrificed his own will to the will of the Father to live a holy life. Verse 14 talks about, for by one sacrifice he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy, and where these have been forgiven, sacrifice for sin is no longer necessary. And so we no longer have to go through those shadow processes of sacrifice in the Old Testament and look forward for the good things to come. The good things have already come. Christ triumphed over death, and the presence of God now no longer only resides in the place of Israel, but it's all over the place. Why? Because God was faithful to his word. But it doesn't end there, it just gets better, because that's how Jesus is. And it's not just for you. So we do a really good job, and I'm just going to go on a bit of a soapbox. We do a great job in church talking about the imminence of God, and so a lot of these songs talk about how God's been faithful to me and how God has done a good work in me. And that is true, but what that can do is create a worldview that's about me. But the truth is that God has done this for us. God has been faithful to us over and over and over again. Like, you forget, actually, you don't even know the generations before you, really. Like, if you go far back enough, you're like, I don't know, maybe they had the last name that I do, but I don't know them. And, like, that's going to be true about you in the future. Like, generations to come aren't really going to know most of us. But God was still faithful in our lives, and that still matters. And so we hold in tension this really beautiful thing that God cares deeply for me, but he also has a plan that's a lot bigger than me. So we get to participate in the life of Christ, but it's what I want to challenge us to think about is, like, we as a collective body get to participate in the glory of Jesus to bring more of Jesus to this world. Because it would be really hard to do that if it were just about you. And so it's comforting to know that it's not only about Sadie and that Sadie doesn't have to save everything. So we're going to zoom out a little bit on what we've talked about so far, and we see that Jesus fulfills the role of high priest and the role of sacrifice. That's been demonstrated to us the past 2 weeks. And his sacrifice was perfect, and that he longs to make us holy. But he doesn't just long to make us holy in the sense of an individual. He longs to make humanity holy again. He created humanity, and it was good, and he wants that back. And so following all of this in Hebrews is a really oddly timed section titled A Call to Persevere in Faith. So you're reading all of this, and you're like, ah, Jesus is sacrifice, and Jesus is faithful, and it's probably about me, but even though the Greek doesn't really have words for just me, like, maybe it's just about me. And then, like, the writer of Hebrews kind of does this 90-degree turn and is like, okay, so now we're going to talk about faith. And verses 19 through 25 go like this. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with the full assurance that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. So we look to the faithfulness of God in our lives, and it's supposed to spur us into greater community. We do this together, and it's not only about you, and that's the best news ever. It's about us. It's about us being together and working toward calling out the faithfulness of God in the places that we're in. I have a really hard time recognizing the faithfulness of God when I'm sitting in a super dark place. And if I don't let community in, it's really hard to get out of there and to see that the faithfulness of God is true. Like, I know he's probably going to break in there, but it's way easier when Sarah or Mallory or Kara is like, hey, do you remember when God was faithful to you? Do you remember when he spoke that deeply into your heart and said that you are my beloved child? And I'm sitting there like, nope, I sure don't. I don't feel it. That's not true. And they're like, no, it's true. Like, that's what we're here for, guys. Like, that's why we're together. That's why we worship together, is because God is faithful to us as a people. And the Lord was faithful over dozens of generations to make perfect a ritual that he himself created in the Old Testament that was supposed to provide the people with a greater access to his presence. And so in the Old Testament, when we see the Israelites like continually being unfaithful, God wasn't like, all right, screw you guys, I'll just figure out a new group of people. No, he went generation to generation to generation to generation, like 60 generations, and said, okay, like here it is, I'm coming to be with you now. Like, okay, here I come, because you're just not gonna, like, it's not satisfying to me, God, that you aren't getting it right. So I'll just come and I'll make it right for you. Like, he perfected it for us because we couldn't get it right. If that's not love, I don't know what is. He was like, okay, you can't do it, I'll do it for you. I'll come down, I will give my life as a perfect sacrifice, I will be perfect forever. You will kill me, and I will still love you. I will come and show my goodness and be in this world, and you will think that it's so radical that you yourselves will kill me, and I will stand there as I'm being beaten and say, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And if that's not love, and if that's not faithfulness, I don't have a better example. And so God is not short-sighted, and he always has his plan, like, and he isn't faithful in order to complete some arbitrary task, but he's faithful because that's who he is. It's at the core of God's character. And so the book of Leviticus ends with a call for the faithfulness of the Israelites, and the end of our passage in Hebrews ends the same way. It's calling for faithfulness from the community to trust in the faithfulness of Jesus to complete the good work that he's begun. So you don't have to trust the faithfulness of yourself to get it right. You don't have to trust that you're faithful enough in God to go to heaven. The thing you have to do is trust that Jesus is faithful. Like, and I can get behind that. Because Jesus is faithful, and I'm just, like, historically not. And it's his good work, so let him be faithful to his own work in your life. And, like, you just get to sit there and let him do it. Like, you don't have to do anything but say yes. And so I guess the book of Leviticus ends the same way our passage in Hebrews ends, which the same way I want to end this, which is to challenge you to just say yes to letting Jesus be faithful in your life. Like, whether that's, okay, Jesus, I am going to say that, like, you're real and trust that that's true, and take step one of faith, awesome. If that's, okay, Jesus, I'm trusting that you're faithful because my best friend just died and I can't see through the dark, like, that's true too. Okay, Jesus, I'm trusting that you're faithful because I know that I'm in a season of celebration that probably won't last forever, so help me cling to your faithfulness to get through the darkness too. Like, whatever season of faithfulness that you're in that you need to rely on Jesus, like, that is what I want us to press into. So the band's going to sing songs, and there's going to be people up here to pray. And if you want just a general blessing, or if there's something super specific that has gone on in your heart over these last couple minutes, let's press into that together. Let's trust that Jesus is faithful to complete his good work and that we just get to participate in it, which is really fun. So Jesus, thank you that you are a good father who loves and lavishes your love upon your children. Thank you that your lens is way bigger than just an individual. Thank you that your goodness spans eternity past. And thank you that you want your people to experience joy. And so God, I pray that whatever season we may be in, whatever moment that is engulfing us right now, God, that we can look straight into your eyes and trust that you're faithful through it all. And if that's hard, that we can trust that we have a community that will stand in the gap and say, I believe God's faithful until you can say it for yourself. We love you a lot. Amen.